This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is John McCain. The Republican senator from Arizona ran against George W. Bush in the 2000 Republican primary. He's considering running for president again in 2008, but says he won't decide until after the midterm elections next year. We've also invited Joe Biden, Democratic Senator of Delaware, to talk with us. Biden, too, is considering running in the next presidential election. We expect to schedule that interview sometime soon. I recorded my interview with Senator McCain yesterday. Before we got to some of the issues of the day, I asked about his new book, Character is Destiny. It's a collection of profiles of people whose lives he thinks adults and children will find inspiring. Senator McCain, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your book, Character is Destiny, you talk a little bit about your own life, and you tell a great story about your mother's objections to the language you once used to describe your experiences as a prisoner of war. Would you tell us that story?
So my mother is now 93. I think she was 90 at the time that an excerpt from the first book that Mark Salter and I wrote called Faith of My Fathers was excerpted in a magazine in Washington. And one of the excerpts that was printed in the magazine was that I was, when I was in prison in Hanoi, when being taken from one cell to another, I would yell obscenities at the guards to try to help the morale of my fellow prisoners who might be listening. We are not allowed to communicate with each other. And so some of those obscenities were printed in this excerpt and in the book. And my mother called and I answered the phone. She said, Johnny. I said, yes, mother. She said, I just read the excerpts from your book in the magazine. I said, well, what'd you think? And she said, well, I'm coming over there and wash your mouth out with soap. I said, Mom, these were bad people. They were hurting me and my friends are very bad people. She said, that's no excuse. Under no circumstances did I ever teach you to use language like that.
So what's the moral of that story in your mind?
The moral of the story is you should always pay attention to your mother and certainly never write something that she might read that you might not want her to.
Yeah, but obviously she was wrong, because there is a place for obscenity, and that would be the place for it, is when you're,
I think so,
people are carrying you away to torture you. That would be the place for obscenity.
But, you know, my mom is, again, she grew up in an age where ladies and gentlemen never used that kind of language anywhere. As she said, under any circumstances. But she's a wonderful woman. She drives herself everywhere. She drove herself across country last Christmas, and I had to alert the local law enforcement agencies along the way. But she's in great shape, and she pays very close attention to my activities, watches my appearances on television and radio, and in Washington quite often I take her to various functions that I go to, and she's always the hit of the evening.
Well, your book is called Character is Destiny, and of course one of the things that formed your character was being a prisoner of war for 5.5 years in Vietnam. And you have introduced an amendment to the defense appropriation bill that the Senate has voted to support, but President Bush has said he will veto it if it passes in the House. This would prohibit cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment in the U.S. interrogations that happen outside of the U.S. Would you explain what you see as the need for this bill?
Well, first, I mentioned about my character being formed by being in prison. I don't think my character was formed in prison. I think it was formed before that. But what I think it made me realize, very frankly, in prison, that I was dependent on others. It was my friends and comrades that picked me up when I was down and literally saved my life, and I always thought that I would be able to do everything for myself, and I found that I was very much dependent upon my comrades, who were my source of strength. And in a couple of cases, a couple of guys that took care of me when I was first a prisoner, that literally saved my life. We have very bad image problem in the world. Some of it deserved, some of it undeserved. That we are mistreating, torturing, treating inhumanely or cruelly people that we hold captive. And Abu Ghraib pictures were shown on Al Jazeera, as we all know, 24/7. And it hurt us in our efforts in Iraq, and it hurts us around the world. any information that can be gained by torture is, one, not reliable, two, torture is not effective, and three, let me just, if I could sum up, there's a great hero of mine. His name is General Jack Vesey. A lot of Americans may not remember him. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, got a battlefield commission. He was a private at a landing at Salerno in Italy, and fought in many wars. He served in the Army for 46 years, and I saw him recently out in Minnesota at a dinner that benefited Iraqi veterans and their families. And I said, "General, what do you think about this issue?" And he said, "Any information that could be gained as a result of cruel, inhumane or treatment or torture could never counterbalance the damage that is done to the United States of America when we do these things." And I think he put it as well as anybody I've ever heard.
Now, you've said that when you were tortured in North Vietnam, that you name names. You name the names of ball players.
Yeah, the starting lineup of the Green Bay Packers. Yep.
So, did that stop the torture? I mean, you gave them names. They were totally inappropriate names for what they were looking for. But did that...
For a while, uh-huh. Yeah. But mainly what they wanted is what you can get out of torture. Mainly what they wanted was to get war crimes, confessions, statements criticizing your country, those kinds of things. It all started really as a science back in the Bolshevik days when they would have the show trials, where these people would literally condemn themselves to death in Soviet Russia and confess to crimes that they couldn't possibly have committed because they'd been tortured to the point where they'd do anything to relieve the pain. You see my point? And by the way, there is one case published in the media that a Al-Qaeda individual was captured and gave information about weapons of mass destruction, which found itself into speeches given by the administration, I think the president, and turned out later on the guy recanted. You see, so it's not that useful, and psychological methodology is far more effective. The Israelis have been prohibited from using torture by their Supreme Court. They use psychological methods.
So you don't trust the information that is extracted under torture? You didn't give accurate information, and you don't trust others would.
No, I don't. I don't trust it. But most importantly, let's suppose that one out of a million cases, that this was one of these things where you really had the hot smoking gun, and you could torture this person. Well, that occasion may arise, and then you have to do what you have to do. But what this has morphed into, apparently from published reports, and I have no secret information. I am not on any of the intelligence committees or anything like that. But according to the Washington Post, we now have prisons in what used to be Eastern Europe. And that's not right. You know, we don't want to do that kind of thing. So
Condoleezza Rice said this week about those prisons. She was criticizing the European critics of these prisons, and she said they should know that these interrogations of suspects have helped save European lives. The interrogations of suspects in these secret prisons in former Soviet bloc countries.
Well, that may be the case. I do not know because I don't have the kind of information she does. I'd be interested in how that happened. But I have to go back again to General Vesey's statement that any information that is gained cannot possibly counterbalance the damage that's done to American image. We're in two wars. We're in a military war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're in a war with the enemy on a battle of ideas. And we have to be better and something different than these people who are bent on our destruction.
You've said that one of the practices that is being examined here is waterboarding, in which the interrogator basically pours water into the nose and mouth of the person being interrogated, and that person thinks that they are drowning. Although they will be rescued from drowning by the interrogator, the person being interrogated doesn't know that. You've said that anything that makes it seem like you are on the verge of getting executed is torture. Do you know that from experience? Were you in that position?
No, it was never that never happened to me. But I know of enough cases where people have believed that they were going to be killed or executed that it has tremendous. Any person who's well versed in the mental impacts of something like that will tell you how damaging that can be. As I said, most people, a beating is far preferable than a mock execution.
Now, I understand that Vice President Cheney has tried to talk you into withdrawing this amendment from the bill. And how? What does he do to try to convince you?
Well, it's well known that publicly Vice President Cheney has said that he objects to this and he feels that it would impair our ability to gather valuable information. We just have a difference of opinion on it. I respect him. We've been friends for 25 years, and he's a patriot and believes in this nation's security as much as I do. We just have a difference of opinion.
Do you think that President Bush will veto the bill if it passes the House? Will veto the bill because of your amendment?
Well, I hope not. We're still in discussions. I had several discussions with Mr. Hadley, the President's National Security Advisor, and I hope that we could work out some accommodation that would preserve the fundamentals of the amendment, but perhaps make the language more palatable in some respects. We're working on it.
I just heard a hum in the background. Is that a plane going by?
Yes.
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 Oh, okay,
yes.
Great. I'll just wait till it goes. Okay. It's going real slowly, isn't it?
It may be a helicopter coming, a black helicopter coming to assassinate me, because that way we can keep, as a dedicated watcher of 24, you never know what can happen. Because, see, they could kill two birds with one stone by wiping out a public, national public radio as well as a political enemy, you see. So it would be hard to resist this target.
This is a dark plot indeed. I think we are nearly safe now. That plane sounds in the distance.
Whew, thank God.
Now, since we've been talking a little bit about, you know, your experience as a prisoner of war and Vietnam and how that applies to your thoughts about torture, there's another Vietnam question I'd like to ask you. The National Security Agency recently released hundreds of pages of formerly secret documents on the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident. And this was the incident which we were told that the North Vietnamese fired on our boats in the Gulf of Tonkin. Mm-hmm. And as a result of this, President Johnson authorized airstrikes and Congress passed a resolution authorizing military action based on the Gulf of Tonkin. Now, these new documents that were released show that our boats really weren't fired on. The Gulf of Tonkin incident never really happened, but information was distorted to make it seem as if it did. As a veteran, what's your reaction to this?
Well, it's not as exciting as you think, in my view, because we've known for a long time that there were questions about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, unquote. There have been speculation about it for a long time. And the more important aspect of this, Terry, is that the firing, suppose that it did happen, this still, is that enough rationale to escalate the conflict to the point where there's 500,000 people there in a full-scale military engagement with 58,000 killed without Congress revisiting the issue? It seems to me that that what you really saw was Congress not playing the role that it's constitutionally appointed to do. You see what I mean?
So you think that whether the Gulf of Tonkin happened or not, Congress should have revisited the issue, and that's the larger problem?
Oh, absolutely, particularly when we went from an escalation, a dramatic escalation. Remember when the Gulf of Tonkin incident took place, there was a relatively small number of American troops on the ground in Vietnam, and it dramatically escalated, and as did the conflict. Congress should have revisited it on numerous occasions, in my view.
Revisited if, it and pulled our troops out? Revisited it and ended the war?
At least made decisions whether to remain there, whether to accept an escalation, whether it was in our national security interest to continue the conflict. They basically took a pass and let the executive branch, until after the Tet Offensive, basically had the administration had a relatively free hand in conducting the conflict.
So you don't feel betrayed by the Gulf of Tonkin?
Well, it's not so much I feel betrayed. I had heard questions about it for many, many years. My dear friend Admiral Stockdale, who passed away a few weeks ago when we came back from prison in Vietnam, because he was involved at that time, stated that he thought that there was some very false aspects of the Gulf of Tonkin resolutions incident. So I was not surprised.
Senator McCain, you supported the invasion of Iraq, and now you support sending in more troops and say to pull out now would likely lead to full-scale civil war. On Sunday, you were on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, and following your interview, he interviewed Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton of the 9/11 Commission, and they were saying that they're very concerned that public security really is not a priority with the Bush administration, and they say the public security is competing with the war in Iraq. Do you agree with that perception that public security is now competing with the war in Iraq?
No, I believe that most administrations are capable of handling more than one issue. I think that a lot of the responsibility for our failures to address some of the issues of homeland security can be placed at the doorstep of Congress. We don't have spectrum for first responders because the Congress, influenced by the National Association of Broadcasters, refuses to do it. We don't have consolidated oversight of Homeland Security because the old bulls in Congress refuse to give up their turf. I think that the funding issue clearly, again, goes back to Congress. Lee Hamilton and Tom Kaine complained bitterly that the same amounts of money go to parts of the country which are very unlikely terrorist targets, and not enough money goes to those areas that need it. And that, again, you can attribute that to Congress. Now, are we paying enough attention to port security and rail security? Probably not. Are mistakes being made by Department of Homeland Security and TSA and others? I would think so. But I would also point out that there's not been another attack, a terrorist attack on U.S. soil since September 11th. And right after September 11th, I don't think you could find an expert in America that didn't believe that there was going to be another attack sooner rather than later. So we have had some success. I don't believe that the Iraq war and homeland security are necessarily exclusive because, as I said on Tim Russert, Mr. Zarqawi and bin Laden have said once they drive us out of Iraq, they will come to the United States after us. That's been their words, not mine.
You've criticized Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld for not having enough troops when we invaded Iraq. Do you hold him responsible for any other things that you consider to have been misjudgments in how the war has been executed?
A number of misjudgments. When the looting started and they failed to put that down with whatever it took, created an environment of chaos and insecurity for the people of Iraq. When we vastly underestimated the challenge of this growing insurgency. There was a period of time, Terry, when things were pretty quiet in Iraq, and we had a window of opportunity to rebuild the infrastructure and address some of the problems that faced the country, and they didn't do it. The administration in Baghdad was poorly done. As you remember, there was General Garner was there and he was out, and then Bremer came in. Mr. Wolfowitz said that we would pay for the war in Iraq with Iraqi oil revenues. When the first insurgents, when the looting started, Secretary Rumsfeld said stuff happens. And then when the insurgency started, he said there was a few dead enders. The reason why I mentioned that there was a gross misunderstanding of the challenge we faced in the post-conflict aspect of Iraq.
Do you think that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld should be asked to resign?
That's up to the President of the United States. The President wants him on his team. I'm not going to question that. I've had, as I said, very strong disagreements because early on, after the initial military phase, I said, you've got to have more troops over there. And I didn't think of it myself. I heard from everybody from sergeant majors to generals saying the same thing, that they didn't have enough troops over there. And we paid a very heavy price for that.
You had the Indian Affairs Committee, which has been investigating the work of lobbyist Jack Abramoff, and he's been accused of defrauding Indian tribes that he represented, tribes that had or were trying to open casinos. He's been indicted in Florida on federal fraud charges and is under investigation by a federal grand jury and two Senate committees, one of which is yours. Recently, his business partner, Michael Scanlon, pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to bribe public officials and defraud Indian tribes, and he agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. Where are you in your investigation with the Indian Affairs Committee?
We're going to write a report, and there may be additional information we may have to look at, but we've pretty well wrapped it up. There were four major tribes that Abramoff and Scanlon ripped off for a total run of $88 million. But when you look at other aspects like telling them to make certain contribution, it gets much higher than that. The Indian Affairs Committee is that. We're supposed to oversight Native Americans, and we were told of this whole thing started by being told of a couple of disgruntled tribal council members in a small tribe in Louisiana, and it blossomed into something far a thousand times greater than I ever thought that it would. And so we've pretty well wrapped up our side of the investigation. We'll be making legislative recommendations and other things. But it's not the job of the Indian Affairs Committee to investigate members of Congress. That's the Ethics Committee and other committees to do that.
But you might have a sense from your perspective of how far-reaching you think this investigation will be in terms of affecting members of Congress, the Department of the Interior, the Christian Coalition has been involved with part of the story. How far do you think it's going to go?
Oh, I think it's going to go a long, long way. I didn't know, frankly, about Mr. Savavian, the one that was recently indicted because he had lied about his purposes of his trip, a golfing trip to Scotland. And there's many things that we don't know about, but there's, and that we know enough about things to know that this thing is going to be very, very big.
And do you think it will be mostly Republicans affected? Will there be Democrats as well, do you think?
I have no idea. I only know what I read in the media. I've heard that some Democrats were also involved in the contributions and letters and things like that, but none of that can I prove. I only most of the stuff now that we get in the media. But let me just tell you, Terry, here's the problem. We have a broken system, legislative process in Washington. Most of the money and many of the policy decisions are now made in the appropriations process. In other words, line items by the thousands are put into appropriations bills, and they are not read, nor are there hearings, and we all vote without having read or scrutinized these appropriations bills. So now if you can get a hold of an influential lobbyist, that person can go to an influential member of Congress and get a line item in for money or policy. So this system is broken of the way we legislate. And that lends itself and opens it up to this kind of Duke Cunningham corruption kind of a situation. And it's terrible, and it's got to be fixed.
So what would be the way of fixing it, do you think?
Do not allow these items to be added on appropriations bills. Just they're there to fund programs that are already authorized. We have an authorization that means you examine an issue or like the need for a new kind of destroyer, and you authorize it. You say, okay, the Navy can build these destroyers. And then the Appropriations Committee appropriates the amount of money. Now the Appropriations Committee will make all kinds of policy changes and put in these line items because they must pass. The appropriations bills must pass because they fund the various branches of government. The authorizing bills do not have to pass. So all of the action goes over to the appropriations bills. The highway bill that had 6,000, it was an appropriations bill, but it basically was a combination of authorizing and spending, 6,000 earmarks in it, 6,140 earmarks. These appropriations bills are full of these earmarks. Most of them have to do with funneling money, but some of them have to do with fundamental policies.
You, of course, co-sponsored the McCain-Feingold campaign reform legislation, which passed. Now, the kind of corruption that you're talking about now, in which lobbyists basically paid to write in certain parts of legislation, campaign reform doesn't affect that particular part of corrupt lobbying. Are you interested in sponsoring any legislation that would directly address that?
Yes. And you will see it within a week or 2 weeks. But again, you can reform the lobbying, more transparency, more reporting, more information about activities of lobbyists. There's a whole lot of thing you can do. But we also have to change the way that Congress works. You've got to go back to the old business of authorizing things and then funding them. I mean, major policy changes have been made on appropriations bills. And many, many extraneous things have been added by the thousands over time. And that's wrong. And until you fix that, you're always going to have people who will take advantage of a system.
How do you think the corruption scandals now are affecting the Republican Party? And, you know, there's, you know, Tom DeLay has been indicted. Congressman Bob Ney of Ohio, who's involved in the Abramoff scandal, resigned. Randy Cunningham resigned after pleading guilty to taking more than $2 million in bribes from defense contractors. So, you know, there's the indictment of Louis Libby. Karl Rove may still be under investigation. There's so much going on right now in terms of, investigations and indictments. So what effect do you think this is having on your party?
Well, I think it's given rise to much lower esteem on the part of the voters. And I think that's directed at both parties in Congress to a significant degree. I think it probably hurts Republicans more than Democrats since we are in power, but it means it's time for us to reform. I think a lot of people who watch the way things work in Washington will say there are cycles of reform and then a need to clean things up and then, you know, sort of a cycle that we go through. Right now, we have to change the way we do business. I've been saying that for some years.
Do you think it's difficult to be in American politics today and remain untainted, remain free from the corrupt influence of money?
Yes. Yes, I do. Most of the men and women I serve with in the Senate and that I served with in the House are good and honorable people. You know, we were finding out that there are some that are not, but the overwhelming majority of them are honorable people.
People who you consider to be inspirational, to be role models, and including Mother Teresa. And you have a daughter that you adopted from an orphanage that I think was run by Mother Teresa. Am I right?
Yes,
about that?
Yes, it was her group of nuns that ran an orphanage in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Yes, that's where my wife was visiting with a medical team, and Bridget was there, and she had a very severe cleft palate, and we're very pleased to have the opportunity and the blessing to bring her home and be part of our family.
When you were running for in the presidential primary in 2000, there was, and I think it's fair to call it a smear campaign against you, which used your daughter. There was like a whisper campaign saying that your daughter was actually a daughter that you had fathered with a black prostitute.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes.
How did this whisper campaign work? Like how do these kinds of rumors travel?
I don't know, because I've never engaged in anything like that. We knew that was out there, and it was very painful for us, of course.
And also in these whisper campaigns were that you were mentally unstable because of your POW experiences and that your wife was an addict. How do you fight against things like that when no one is taking credit for saying it? And it's all, my understanding is it's like phone calls that come across on like two-way talk radio and like little handouts that are anonymously placed on cars and parking lots. And it's hard to trace back to an individual.
Well, it's very tough, and it was very difficult. But I would also point out that one of the major reasons why we lost in South Carolina was not because of that, as much as it was that the entire Republican establishment supported President Bush, then Governor Bush, and were behind him. And he had a great deal more money to spend than we did, and they were better organized than we were in many respects. So, look, I didn't like, Terry, the things that happened. But for me to look back in anger over something that happened back 5 years ago is not appropriate. I want to move forward. I want to put it behind me, and I want to serve the people of Arizona in the Senate. I think it's wrong to hold a grudge in American politics.
Well, I wanted to ask you about it because it may be symptomatic of a larger problem in politics today, which is the smear campaign. I mean, would you say that there's a difference between playing hardball politics and smearing somebody?
Yeah, but you know, I observed both the Virginia and the New Jersey governor's races here just recently, and it seemed to me they had it to a pretty good art form. You know, I laugh about it, but really, it's unfortunate. We need a different level of dialogue in American politics and electoral process. The thing that's most damaging of all about it is that young people are so turned off by it that it's hard to get qualified and ambitious young Americans to seek public office. That's why I mind it more than anything else.
You know, when you're smeared from somebody in the other party, you may be expected a little bit more, but when it's happening from your own party in a primary, is it more surprising, and does it make it more difficult to feel really united with your party when you know people within that party have lied about you in such such a really destructive way?
Well, I found in my experience probably the most bitter campaigns are primaries within the party, because you know there's not much of a philosophical difference, so they get into other things. So primaries are usually pretty bloody and bitter, sometimes more so than a general election. But the other thing about it is, Terry, politics is not beanbag. And it gets tough. It's not beanbag, and it's tough, and it's difficult. But I think that what you really need to look at is the campaign that you waged. Overall, with some mistakes and some excesses, I'm very proud of the campaign that we ran, and I'm proud when I look back on it, the people that supported us and the people that rallied to us, and I'm very proud of the job that we did. And for me to be angry 5 years later and say this person did this or that person did it or they did this, look, Americans want us to move on. And I was just reelected to the Senate in the last election in 2004. I campaigned for the people of Arizona. I said, let me represent you and your interests and your values and your ambitions, not look back in anger at something that happened in a primary in South Carolina. Not only do I not hold a grudge, as you know, I campaigned very vigorously for the reelection of President Bush, and I was glad to do so.
Again, I was asking not because of holding a grudge, but because, you know, your campaign isn't the only campaign that this kind of thing has happened in. And I'm wondering if you think that there's something that can be done to stop to stop those kind of smears. And I'm wondering, too, if you consider the Swifbo campaign against John Kerry similar in fashion to the smear campaign against you, or if you consider that to be, you know, a different animal altogether.
Well, I think it was different in many respects, because this was a paid-for ad campaign. What happened to us was all sort of under the radar kind of thing. In the campaign that you're talking about in South Carolina, I think that the media can play a more instructive role. Maybe if the media had exposed some of this stuff more widely, we could have done a better job, and maybe we should have done a better job in exposing it. In the Swiftboat campaign, I immediately condemned the attacks on John Kerry's combat record. I said it was dishonest and dishonorable to question his performance for this nation in combat. Now, any time before or after his role in combat, then I think it's relatively fair game. But no, I did not approve of the attacks on John Kerry's combat record, because he served honorably in Vietnam, just as President Bush, in my view, served honorably in the National Guard.
I want to read you something that John Dickerson wrote in Slate magazine in November 29th, and he was talking about how some Republicans, how the president now has a kind of negative coattail effect, that some Republicans are trying to keep their distance because the president's ratings have gone so low, and because the war has become more unpopular. But you continue to support him and are not concerned about being associated with him. So Dickerson writes, McCain can embrace Bush without being hurt by the affiliation because voters think he's winking as he does it. McCain's fans see his stumping for Bush and his politics as being pro forma and insincere. What would you say about that?
Well, I know John Dickerson very well, and I appreciate his views. But the reason why I have the popularity that I have is that people don't believe that I conduct myself with a wink and a nod, that I believe that I do things that I believe in, whether they happen to be popular or not. And I take these positions recognizing that at the moment, or even long term, it may not be the same as a majority of the American people. But I've continued to do what I believe is right, and in my heart, I believe I'm right. I campaigned for President Bush for re-election because I thought I know that the transcendent issue of the 2004 campaign and maybe 2008 is who's best equipped to win the war on terror. And I was convinced then, and am to this day, that President Bush is better equipped to do so. Did we have some disagreements? Of course. But in all respect to my friend John Dickerson, I think that people accept my positions because they believe that they're sincerely held. And they are sincerely held, I can assure you of that. And they come from long years of experience and study and having people that advise me and I consult with that I respect and admire.
Now, you're going to wait till after the midterm elections to decide whether you want to run or not in 2008. If you do run, you'd be 72 at the time of the election, which would be 2 years older than Ronald Reagan was when he ran for president, and he was the oldest person to win the presidency. So is that an issue for you at all?
Not for me. And at the beginning of the program, you mentioned my 93-year-old mother. I think I would try to take her with me wherever I go.
You're going to make the good genes argument.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking
with us. Thank you, Terry.
Senator John McCain, he has a new book called Character is Destiny. We've invited Democratic Senator Joe Biden to be our guest and expect to have that interview scheduled sometime soon.